where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratch surfaces point to a different origin. Why you, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world, and this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. Take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold. 300 million PCs. And 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
Human rights groups reacted with outrage to video footage showing Israeli regime troops forcing Palestinian children from their slumber and photographing them outside their family home, an act that the Zionist regime's military admits was not proper. One Israeli human rights group said the incident illustrates how arbitrarily the routine of the lives of Palestinians living under occupation is disrupted and how easily troops violate their rights. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Morally Repugnant. Video shows Zionist regime troops waking and photographing Palestinian kids. Stay tuned for more. Human rights groups recently reacted with outrage to video footage showing Israeli regime troops forcing Palestinian children from their slumber and photographing them outside their family home, an act that the Israeli regime's military admits was not proper. The footage, first published on Wednesday, November 17th, by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, captures an incident that occurred on September 3rd in the unlawfully occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Their recording shows IDF, that is Israeli forces, troops ordering adult Palestinians to wake the frightened children, 13 of whom are gathered into a group and then told to say cheese before being photographed outside the home. A woman in the home asks the troops, "Do you like when the soldiers come and take pictures of your kids?" One of the Israeli troops explains that the children are being photographed because they're throwing stones here, a reference to the futile yet symbolic act of Palestinian youth hurling rocks at heavily armored IDF vehicles. Salem said that the video shows how arbitrarily the routine of the lives of Palestinians living under occupation is disrupted and how easily Israeli regime troops violate their rights. The group added, it seems that for the army, all Palestinians, including boys and girls of elementary school age, are potential criminals. They are allowed to wake them up at any time at night, enter their house and conduct a lineup. The London-based pro-Israel Jewish group Yachad UK called the incident morally repugnant. Dylan Williams, senior vice president of the US-based pro-Israel lobby group J Street, said the troops committed a violation of international law. He added, if any of the arms or equipment used by Israeli forces during this were US-sourced, it's also a violation of US law. According to the IDF, the home was invaded following a stone-throwing incident at the nearby illegal Israeli settler colony of Kirat Arba. An IDF official said, according to the Times of Israel, during the incident, minors were photographed by the officer to identify the stone-throwers. This officer's conduct was not proper, the army official added. The officer has received a reprimand on his conduct, and procedures will be sharpened among the forces to prevent the recurrence of similar cases. In what the IDF called intelligence mapping, troops entered the homes of Palestinians who are not suspected of any wrongdoing at night in order to gain knowledge of the building's residence and layouts. In June, the IDF announced it would significantly curtail the controversial practice. Earlier this month, Common Dreams reported that the IDF veterans group Breaking the Silence revealed a sweeping IDF West Bank surveillance operation in which troops are using facial recognition technology integrated with ubiquitous security cameras and smartphones to compile a database of as many Palestinians as possible. To build the database, IDF troops held competitions to see who could take the most photos of Palestinians, including children. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz noted that it is illegal for IDF troops to photograph minors.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The cost of living in the UK surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
Now, there's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market. So, of course, prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
Now, there are two aspects of all of this. Inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. On the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation after Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas, following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year, and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
The Sudanese military forced Omar al-Bashir out of the presidential post in August 2019. After Bashir's ouster, the military came under mounting pressure by mass street demonstrations demanding civilian rule. The military finally agreed to share power with civilian leaders. The two sides agreed to negotiate a path towards a democratic government. After the agreement, civilians and military leaders formed a joint committee known as the Sovereign Council to run the country together in what appeared to be a transition period before a democratically elected government takes charge. But the two sides were publicly at odds from the very beginning. Military leaders of the Sovereign Council kept demanding their civilian counterparts to replace the cabinet and implement reforms. Civilian leaders dismissed this as an attempt to seize power. Sudan experienced several failed coups since 2019. The country is right now in political turmoil following the military's latest try. Back in October, the military arrested Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and his cabinet members and dissolved the government. Is the army trying to keep power, or is it genuinely committed to holding elections as it has promised? Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman Burhan says a vote will be held in July 2023. But Sudanese activists and demonstrators seem not to be buying that pledge. They have held several mass demonstrations calling on the general to cede power immediately. The army has clamped down on the protests in recent weeks, but the demonstrators seem to be undeterred by the bloody crackdown. The crackdown on anti-coup protesters has been getting bloodier. This means that pro-democracy camps and activists are facing an increasingly dangerous struggle. The violent crackdown has triggered international condemnation, with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet describing it as utterly shameful to use live bullets against protesters. The current situation in Sudan is reminiscent of June 2019, before the democratic transition was agreed. That year, the army opened fire on protesters in the capital, Khartoum, killing scores of people. Undaunted by the latest violence, opponents of the coup have now pledged to intensify their protests against the military takeover. The Sudanese Professional Association, which led the popular uprising that toppled Omar al-Bashir, has been a major force against coup leaders. It has called for civil disobedience across Sudan. The African country is on the edge. Popular movements in Sudan have in the past been successful in forcing the generals to limit their involvement in politics. Is that the path the Sudanese people need to take again?
I do think that what we saw in 2019 with the protests were extremely positive in showing the rest of the world what the Sudanese people can do and what the Sudanese masses can do. However, even the Sudanese Communist Party had mentioned how important it was to recognize that the material impact of the protests have not been recognized by the masses themselves. So the poor and working class Sudanese people have not yet seen any of their material needs resolved as a result of the protests. So that's probably the biggest push they're trying to see now, is ensuring that this next government actually does listen to their needs, material needs.
What's making the situation even worse this time is Sudan's economic crisis, with high inflation and nationwide shortages of food and fuel. The Sudanese army chief seems to have the final say, at least for now. But he is definitely in no easy position as tensions escalate and people lose their lives in violence. The international community has left little doubt that it disapproves of the developments in Sudan. All eyes are on the army now to see what direction it will choose.
There is no end in sight for the plight of the Rohingya Muslims. Already living in sprawling refugee camps that are said to be one of the most densely populated places on earth, the Muslims in the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar say they are being hunted down by police and local criminal gangs alike. Following the assassination of prominent Rohingya activist Mohibullah in September, the Bangladeshi police have launched a heavy-handed crackdown on the camp residents. The refugees say the law enforcement is using the crackdown as an excuse to treat them aggressively. They allege that the police have blackmailed, extorted, and even sexually assaulted them.
There's no safety and security in the camp, and that is why anyone can come in and commit crimes, and not many people dare enough to make noise in order to talk about the gang activities or any criminal activities because they become the target.
According to a New York Times report, the refugees are being put on a hit list by violent gangs. In less than a month, at least 8 people have reportedly been assassinated by ARSA, a large militant group that is trying to impose its own rule over the displaced Rohingya.
ARSA, the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army. They enter the camp for years, coming in to recruit their troops or coming in and doing other businesses. And also you have drug dealers, drug traffickers who come in and making profit out of the refugees. And you also have other perpetrators who come in, prey on women and children, and human traffickers to abduct people to just sell them to other countries.
The menaces the refugees are facing come on top of the poor living conditions in the overcrowded shelters and inclement weather that's threatening their lives and what's left of their belongings. The United Nations and Bangladesh's government signed a deal in mid-October to work together to aid and serve Rohingya refugees on Basan Char Island in the Bay of Bengal, where more than 19,000 people have been relocated from overcrowded camps near Myanmar's border. According to the UN, the agreement allows the refugees to move back and forth between the island and the main camp in Cox's Bazar. The UN has also noted that moving to the island would be voluntary. Authorities in Bangladesh have announced that another 81,000 refugees would be relocated to the island over the next 3 months. The development comes as most of the Rohingya refugees are not pleased with the relocation and say life on the island is hard for them. The agreement has also marked a shift, as the UN used to criticize the relocation, saying the island was regularly hit by cyclones, heavy monsoon rains, floods, landslides and other natural hazards and was not fit for habitation. However, the Bangladeshi government claims that it has spent tens of millions of dollars on the island's development, insisting that it's no longer a vulnerable area.
Those who are in the authority, they've been informed. But then the UNHCR will be saying, oh, that's the Bangladesh government authority and responsibility to take care of the refugee security. But at the same time, you also have the Bangladesh government who is worrying that the Rohingya will be living here forever if they feel safe. They wouldn't want to go anywhere or go back to Burma.
The standards of living haven't changed much for the refugees in the past few years. They were facing murder, rape, and torture at home. The same atrocities are haunting them kilometers away in Bangladesh.
A new report by The Times has revealed detail about one of the largest civilian casualty incidents in U.S. history. On 18th of March 2019, the U.S. military carried out an attack in the town of Baruz in eastern Syria. An F-15E attack jet targeted a crowd of people in Baruz with a 500-pound bomb. 5 minutes later, it dropped another even bigger bomb, and then another. Initial battle damage assessments put the death toll at around 70. The Times also revealed that following this strike, the U.S.-led coalition forces had bulldozered the blast site to cover up the incident. The U.S. military didn't publicly acknowledge the incident, and the death toll was downplayed. Finally, this week, U.S. Central Command acknowledged the attacks for the first time. It said 80 people were killed in the airstrike, including 16 Daesh terrorists and 4 civilians. However, saying it was not clear if the other 60 were civilians, it justified the killings by saying women and children might have been Daesh members. The report says the death toll was almost immediately apparent to the military officials. It said an Air Force lawyer present in the operation center at the time believed the attacks were possible war crimes, but regulations for investigating the potential crime were not followed.
Well, you know, in an ideal world, there would be a prosecution, there would be a trial and a proper hearing, but the way the world is run today, it's highly unlikely that the United States will, first of all, recognize any international court, and second of all, follow the judgment of such a court.
The admission was rather unusual, as more often civilian deaths are undercounted by the U.S. military, even in classified reports. Pentagon recently admitted that a drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul on August 29th was a botched strike. It killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. The attack came amid the hasty withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and days after a suicide bombing in Kabul International Airport that killed over 150 Afghans as well as 13 U.S. service members. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group named Air Wars showed that since 2001, at least 22,679 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as over 48,300.
Well, the fact is that if the world's so-called sole superpower can flex its muscles anywhere it chooses, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of international law, and regardless of public opinion worldwide, this gives the worst possible example to American allies, and that is follow the leader. If the United States can kill people at whim, at any place, at any time, then presumably its allies can do similar things.
Pakistan, in particular, has been the victim of U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. began its attacks in 2004 to kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. There are questions about how many civilians have been killed as a result of these strikes. According to the highest estimates, these strikes have killed thousands of people. The U.S. military, from CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. Nearly 1,000 strikes hit targets in Syria and Iraq in 2019 using 4,729 bombs and missiles. The official military tally of civilian death for that entire year is only 22, and the strikes from March 18 are nowhere on the list.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Muslims' duty towards the all-inclusiveness of Islam, promoting Islam's viewpoint.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The Quran has verses about security and the safety of people in society. Truly, if the hypocrites and those in whose hearts is a disease and those who stir up sedition in the city desist not, we shall certainly stir you up against them. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 60. Another verse says, when there comes to them some matter touching public safety or fear, they divulge it. If they had only referred it to the messenger, the Holy Quran, Surah 4, verse 83. These verses mean that Islam has an opinion on all important aspects of social life. The verses I have mentioned are a small part of those that exist in the Holy Quran. Hundreds of such examples can be seen in the Quran. A person who is interested in and is familiar with the Quran and its rules understands that this is the Islam that the Quran teaches. The kind of Islam that the Quran defines and introduces is an Islam that is involved in all aspects of life and that has opinions, viewpoints, and demands. Well, we should know this, and we should answer those who try to deny this clear truth.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
On the other hand, because there are social issues and important tasks that need to be done, such as building a society and civilization in Islam, Islam attends to the issue of governance as well. It is not the case that Islam would demand social order, but not clarify the issue of leadership for religious and worldly affairs. When religion becomes a system related to the individual and society, and becomes a system that has opinions and demands on all individual and social issues, then it is necessary to determine who it is at the head of this society and what characteristics this head should have. Thus, religion must appoint an imam.
You've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on six Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American people.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Democratic Party repeatedly criticized Donald Trump during his term for his way of dealing with Iran and withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement. But ironically, since he came to power, Biden persisted in his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and even imposed more sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This is why U.S. media and officials have admitted that the campaign against Iran has failed. Tehran held several rounds of talks with the FIPOR Plus One group between April and June with the aim of removing the sanctions, but no breakthrough was reached. Now, as the new round of talks scheduled to start on November 29th draws nearer, the U.S. measures against Iran further question Washington's sincerity about the issue, regardless of which party is at the helm in the White House.
Rights groups and families of missing persons held a press conference in Karachi to once again voice their grave concerns over the non-recovery of their loved ones, slamming the government for its lack of seriousness in their recovery. Last Saturday, families of Shia missing persons changed their direction towards military offices known to be the real powerhouses in Pakistan.
Victims' families are outraged over the law enforcement agencies who they now accuse for clamping down on their right to protest. They are calling on the government to prosecute those responsible for abduction of their loved ones in the court of law.
The family says state institutions are open for talks with Takfiri terrorists who have killed over 70,000 Pakistanis but are not serious to recover missing persons.
From 2009, we are protesting for the safe release of my father, and I have knocked every door of justice to the Supreme Court, High Court, and on the Commission of Enforced Disappearance, but I didn't get any positive result, or yet I still don't know where my father is.
The first post 9/11 reported case of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia, who was kidnapped from Karachi along with her three kids in 2003.
Those who at the end of the day come for the agreement, those who at the end of the day come for the negotiations, that we have your men and we'll release them let's say after 2 months, after 3 months, those are the real people. These agencies, these people who should not be named in this country, these people who are above the law, who are beyond the law, these are the real authorities, these are the real officers whose job is to run this country, but in actual they are destroying this country.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
People in Indian-controlled Kashmir have closed businesses, shops and other routine activities following a shutdown call by the pro-freedom outfit Hurriyat Conference over the recent civilian killings in a suspected encounter in Srinagar earlier this week. The streets of Srinagar appeared deserted and guarded by the government forces. Since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi's crackdown on pro-freedom groups and its activities has kept the space for dissent here, thus adding to the frustrations among the local residents. Analysts call it an enforced silence. The shutdown comes 4 days after the killing of civilians in a suspected encounter in Indian-controlled Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar. Denouncing the police claims, the families of victims protested against the dubious killings and the secret burial of civilians. This forced Indian authorities to return the dead bodies to their respective families for a proper burial. Political leaders, social activists, and residents took to social media in support of victim families, urging authorities to conduct a probe into the killings. 14-year-old Noha Altaf has bid farewell to her father. What she is demanding now is justice.
Decent burial was our right. They have done no favor to us. But now is the time for them to do justice. The culprits must be hanged for killing my innocent father, so that it sets an example and such incidents should never happen again. None in Kashmir must go through what we have gone through.
According to police, 4 people were killed in Monday's encounter. The bodies of 2 civilians have been handed over, while the 3rd civilian has been buried in an inaccessible area, and the identity of the 4th person remains unknown. Shahana Butt, Indian-controlled Kashmir.
The long-standing rivalry between Russia and the United States has taken a new turn. This time, Washington is mulling whether or not to recognize the presidency of Vladimir Putin if he is re-elected. This is proposed in a cross-party resolution introduced by 2 U.S. congressmen. It calls for the U.S. to end its recognition of Vladimir Putin's presidency beyond his current term, which expires in May 2024. The bill claims that the recent amendments to the Russian Constitution, which enabled the Russian president to run for another term, are legally void. The motion has drawn fierce condemnation from the Kremlin.
Every time we think there is nothing more absurd, aggressive, unfriendly, and unconstructive that can come from that side of the ocean, and every time we are wrong, unfortunately, this is a perfect demonstration not only to Russia, but to all countries of the world that the United States officially interferes in the internal affairs of other countries.
It was only a few years ago when I believe around 100,000 advertisements made on Western social media were enough cause to launch investigations, create this whole supposedly Russiagate scandal accusing Trump of some sort of collusion or whatever. This seems to be a vastly higher level of meddling into the affairs of a foreign country. So it seems very hypocritical on its surface.
But the U.S. is no stranger to getting involved in other nations' internal affairs. Just this Tuesday, President Joe Biden banned members of the Nicaraguan government from entering the United States. He alleged that Nicaragua's November 7 vote was rigged in favor of President Daniel Ortega. In response, the Nicaraguan Congress denounced Washington for violating the principle of non-intervention in its foreign policy. Washington's failure to recognize the elected leaders of such nations as Syria and Venezuela has also drawn strongly worded condemnations for years. The U.S., however, presses on with the interference, which runs contrary to the Charter of the United Nations.
Yeah.
It appears that once again, outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel has had to clean up a big mess for the EU. She spoke directly with the President of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, and now the migrant crisis on the Belarus-Poland border has eased. However, the EU is pressing ahead with fresh sanctions against Belarus.
These discussions, as always, are taking place among the member states in the Council in the atmosphere of confidentiality, and we never disclose any details about ongoing discussions about who will be or who might be on that sanctions list.
The EU accuses Belarus and Russia of weaponizing migration in retaliation for sanctions. Vladimir Putin claims the West is using migrants as an excuse to heighten tensions with Moscow and Minsk. Alexander Lukashenko says genuine refugees can seek asylum in Belarus, just like in any other country. Around 2,000 migrants had gathered in appalling conditions on the Belarus side of the Belarus-Poland border. Having been aggressively pushed back from the EU by Polish authorities, they have now been relocated to a warehouse in Belarus. They are mainly from the Middle East and Asia. A sizable number of EU legislators are furious at how the leaders of their countries have treated these migrants. The 27-nation bloc's policy, they say, is to prevent asylum seekers from coming here, which is in contravention of international law. Observers say there is a great deal of hypocrisy on display.
At the moment, they're opposed to Poland, for instance, building a wall on the Belarus border. But of course, the EU itself funded billions of euro to build a wall between Syria and Turkey.
Other political commentators regularly make the point Western powers have a special responsibility to take in refugees in the light of the devastating, destabilizing impact their aggressive foreign policy has had in Africa and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Another Palestinian prisoner has died in one of the Israeli jails as a result of medical negligence. Sameh Moore, 39 years old, died in custody at the Israeli Soroka Hospital in Bir al-Sabah in Al-Naqab. Amour from Deir al-Balah City in the Gaza Strip was imprisoned since 2008, and he suffered from congenital heart problems. According to the Palestinian Prisoners' Society, Amour was transferred several days ago from Nafha prison to Asqalam. He was then transferred to Soroka Hospital after his health deteriorated. The Prisoners' Society held Israel responsible for Amour's death because of the deliberate medical negligence and inappropriate detention conditions.
Medical treatment is among the basic rights of each man according to all international laws. Many Palestinian prisoners have died because of medical negligence. Omar was suffering from serious deteriorated health conditions. The Israeli prison authorities knew that he was in pain and had heart problems, but they never provided him with even medical examinations. It was a slow killing policy that Israel used against Omar and is now using against other prisoners as well.
227 Palestinian prisoners have died in Israeli jails and detention centers since 1967. Hundreds of other prisoners have lost their lives shortly after their release. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the main reason for the deaths of majority of those prisoners was lack of medical care.
Umur is the latest victim of Israel's deliberate medical negligence. This is one of the most prominent systematic policies that have killed many prisoners in Israeli jails. Since 1967, 227 prisoners have died behind bars. Israel continues its policies and crimes amid the international silence.
According to a statement by the Prisoners' Society, some 5,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Some 550 of the detainees suffer from very difficult health conditions due to chronic diseases and inhumane Israeli policy concerning their treatment. The death of Sami Amour sheds light on the suffering of hundreds of sick prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners' organizations call for an immediate international intervention to save the lives of these prisoners. They also warn that Israeli jails might turn into graves for severely ill detainees, as Israel insists on keeping them behind bars without offering appropriate medical care. Muna Khandil, occupied Ramallah.
In
Women's Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and Children has held an event in the capital Sana'a to mark the International Day for Children's Rights. The local body released a report highlighting the tragic situation of Yemeni children amid the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade for the course from March 2015 to November 2021.
For 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition, with the support of the United States, has been carrying out airstrikes and killing Yemeni children. This is a flagrant violation of international law that guarantees the protection of children during conflicts and wars. The Saudi-led coalition seeks to destroy the future of the Yemeni people by targeting educational facilities and depriving the children of their basic rights. These children are the basic foundation for building a new Yemen when the war ends.
The report says 300 Yemeni children die every day due to the lack of health services. The number of children suffering from cancerous tumors has also reached 71,000 as a result of the Saudi-led coalition's use of internationally prohibited weapons in bombing residential areas.
There is injustice and grave violation of rights against the Yemeni children. On top of them, it is the right to live. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has targeted schools and disrupted the educational process. The right to access healthcare also does not exist amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport and the lack of necessary medicines. When we talk about children's rights in Yemen, we feel pain, and only those who experienced it will feel this pain. The children of Yemen celebrate International Day for Children's Rights because it gives them hope despite their stolen rights.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children, and displaced millions more.
Yemenis say the atrocities of Saudi Arabia and the suffering of the Yemeni children are the results of the years-long war and siege imposed on the country. They believe that the UN's removal of Riyadh from the list of parties responsible for gay violations against children last year has emboldened the kingdom to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
July 14, 2015. After years of negotiations, Iran signed a deal with the US, the UK, France, Germany, China, and Russia, which put caps on Tehran's nuclear program in return for sanctions removal. The agreement was dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. At first, it seemed like there was a new era of cooperation between Iran and the West, but that optimism was soon shattered by Washington. In 2016, Donald Trump won the race to become the President of the United States. During his tenure, he adopted an increasingly hostile attitude toward Tehran. This enmity reached a peak in 2018 when Trump unilaterally pulled his country out of the Iran nuclear deal, violating an international accord and a Security Council resolution that endorsed it. He then reinstated previous sanctions on Tehran and even imposed new ones. At the same time, he threatened other parties to the deal, including its allies, with sanctions if they refused to comply with Washington's anti-Iran measures. Despite the US withdrawal, Tehran declared that it would continue respecting its commitments under the agreement. That is, if the remaining parties, referred to as the P4 plus 1 group, guaranteed Iran's benefits as was promised under the JCPOA. Iran showed ample patience for the other sides to honor their end of the bargain. In fact, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in its 16 reports, confirmed Tehran's full compliance with the JCPOA until 2019. It was in May that year, and a whole year after the US withdrawal, that the country started scaling back its commitments when Britain, France, and Germany failed to keep their end of the deal. Iran's remedial measures were in line with mechanisms foreseen in the text of the JCPOA, particularly Articles 36 and 37. The country, on numerous occasions, said it would reverse those measures if the other parties respected their commitments. But after more than 3 years following Washington's unilateral pullout, Iran could not see any change on the part of the Western signatories. Ironically, the new US administration under President Joe Biden persisted with its predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Between April and June this year, Tehran held talks with the P4 plus 1 group with the aim of removing the sanctions that had been